We need to look at this as the Taliban responding to U.S. pressure.
Afghan attacks test regional security strategies. It's Tuesday, January 30th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Hello and welcome. Join us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, President Trump's State of the Union as it relates to China. China and Japan seek common ground on trade. The Koreas unify on the ice hockey rink. Autonomous family driving replacing your joints. It's all on today's VOA Asia. 11 members of the Afghan National Army were killed and 16 others wounded in an early morning attack on a military academy in Kabul Monday. A spokesman for the Afghan Defense Ministry says the attack was against an army unit providing security for the academy and not for the academy itself. Five suicide bombers are said to have carried out the attack. Islamic State has claimed responsibility. Javed Faisal, the deputy spokesman for the Office of Afghanistan's chief executive, tweeted the five suicide bombers were the members of the Haqqani Network. The network is part of the Afghan Taliban and is blamed for many of the deadliest attacks inside Afghanistan. Michael Kugelman, deputy director and senior associate for South Asia at the Wilson Center, tells VOA why the Taliban would be involved.
We need to look at this as the Taliban responding to U.S. pressure. The U.S. is going after the Taliban. It's intensifying the fight on the battlefield. And the Taliban clearly wants to demonstrate to the United States and to Afghanistan that this will not weaken the Taliban, that it remains strong. And so I think this is why the Taliban is increasing these attacks in cities, where it will get a lot of media attention and a lot of attention, essentially to say, well, look, you may try to intensify the fight against us, but it's not going to work, and we're still strong, and we can prove it with these attacks in Kabul and in other Afghan cities.
This is a third attack in Kabul in 10 days. An attack on Kabul's Intercontinental Hotel earlier resulted in several dozen killed, including 14 foreigners. The U.S. State Department confirmed Americans were among the foreigners, but did not disclose how many. The Afghan Taliban claimed both the Intercontinental attack as well as the attack this past weekend. The latest attack comes on a day when the city is still reeling with the aftermath of another deadly attack that killed more than 100, including many policemen. The entire country observed Sunday as a day of mourning. Nationwide prayer services were planned for those victims today. Michael Kugelman says tighter security is an urgent priority for the Afghan government.
Quite frankly, at this moment in time, Afghanistan is experiencing an extremely serious security crisis. And I think that the most important thing now, the priority, is for it to be focusing on its security crisis, all of these attacks happening. And I think in that regard, it needs to emphasize diplomacy with its closest security partners, including the United States.
Monday's attack also coincided with the visit of Indonesian President Joko Widodo, who was in town for a day. Earlier, he had visited neighboring Pakistan, where he had proposed the establishment of a committee of Islamic scholars from Indonesia, Afghanistan, and Pakistan to promote a peaceful settlement of the Afghan conflict. The United States and Afghanistan accused Pakistan of providing safe havens to the leadership of the network, along with the leadership of the Afghan Taliban. Michael Kugelman tells VOA the United States may have other options to deal with the issue.
My view is that the U.S. will try other pressure points beyond freezing aid, which has already happened. I understand the U.S. government is already trying to plan ways to mitigate possible Pakistani retaliations. So that suggests the U.S. will use pressure points. I do not think the U.S. will declare Pakistan as a state sponsor of terror. That would be a very dramatic pressure point. That would not only probably not work, but it would probably mean that Pakistan would retaliate by closing down supply lines on its soil used by NATO forces to access Afghanistan.
Pakistan claims it has carried out military operations to purge its territory of any sanctuaries, and there are no more safe havens on its soil. These are among some of the top Asia stories trending on VOAnews.com. 11 killed in second attack in 3 days in Kabul. U.S. explores ties with controversial Indonesian army unit. U.S.-Vietnam military ties warn China over maritime expansion. India to regain title of fastest-growing economy. North and South Korea hit by flu outbreaks ahead of the Olympics. Expanded coverage of these stories and more are on Facebook at VOA Asia and also visit our voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. President Donald Trump intends to use his first State of the Union address later Tuesday to cite economic progress under his watch. The White House says the president will point to a robust economy and low unemployment during his first year and the benefits of a tax reduction. But what about the economy as it applies to international dealings, especially when it comes to the United States and China? VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Dr. Barry Naughton, professor of economics at the School of Global Policy Strategy at the University of California in San Diego, California.
Barry, a New York Times article Sunday headlined that at the just-concluded Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, the real star may have been China and not Donald Trump. Do you agree with that?
I think to a certain extent there's some truth to that. We know that the Chinese policy advisor, Liu He, was at Davos, and his talk was also very well attended. Perhaps not as many people there as at President Trump's, but people were very, very interested to see what Mr. Liu had to say. So I think there is some truth to the idea that China has taken the initiative in terms of global economic policy.
Is it fair to say, and I quote from a New York Magazine article earlier this month, it said, China has never seen such a moment when its pursuit of a larger role in the world coincides with America's pursuit of a smaller one.
Yes, I think that's exactly right. But it's not so much, it's not solely, I would say, that that President Trump is looking for a smaller role for the United States. It's also that the signals coming out of Washington are so difficult for people to read that in a way they've given up on reading it. So, in other words, people go to Davos and they're very, very interested to know what President Trump is going to say, but then when he makes some statements, he said some potentially very interesting things, right? He said the United States would consider negotiating with the TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership countries, as a group, which would be a dramatic shift in U.S. policy. But the problem is everybody shrugs and says, well, does he mean it or not? We don't know. We have to wait and see. So I think there's a very strange situation going on where China is sending signals which are complex but meaningful. I mean, they don't necessarily mean exactly what they seem to say on the surface, but there certainly is a intentional signaling going on from China. Whereas for the United States, we get these signals coming from Washington, and we can't read them. We can't understand how serious they are. So I think people in the rest of the world are sort of waiting for the United States, but engaging actively with China, since that's the new power that they have to think about.
Do you view this as being dangerous to the United States in any way?
I view it as being extremely dangerous for the United States. I mean, when we think of the United States and China as two large economies and two potential global powers, you know, there's no question that the United States is ahead in many ways, but it's not that much farther ahead. And China has the dramatic advantage that a very large proportion of the economy's resources can be controlled by the government and can be used by the government in pursuit of strategic objectives when the government chooses to do that. Of course, it obviously can't choose to do that all the time because economic resources need to fulfill their economic purposes, but the potential is there. Now, offsetting that potential is the fact that the U.S. has numerous economically, politically, and militarily strong allies. So as long as the U.S. is coordinating with its allies, I think there's no fundamental issue. The strength of the U.S. alliance system is not only stronger than China, but stronger than China will ever be.
But is it not true that that list of allies of the United States is growing shorter?
Well, I think it's not so much that it's fundamentally growing shorter as that our allies are throwing up their hands and they're saying, what does the U.S. want? Where is it going? How should we protect our interests? I mean, to take just two clear examples, Korea, meaning South Korea, and Mexico. These are two countries that want very much to cooperate with the United States, that are have very large, in the case of Korea, or rapidly growing, in the case of Mexico, interactions with China, and would like to coordinate a response with the United States. And they can't, because American policy towards them is so inconsistent and even, we'd have to say, flighty.
Well, China is not only expanding in places that where it has perhaps expanded before, but it seems to be making worldwide moves, does it not? A recent attempt to talk with the countries in South America, what's happening in Africa, has been happening for a while now. This is global, is it not?
It absolutely is. I mean, and, you know, China has a global reach, and it is the second largest economy in the world. So, you know, this is going to happen no matter what. China will have closer relations with Southeast Asian countries. It will have increasing relations with Latin America. I mean, that's just something we have to accept. And after all, it's not something that we can't live with. In other words, we can be happy with a China that is increasing its economic interactions with every country in the world. But to do that, I think we have to have a stable and coherent policy that brings us closer to our allies.
Doesn't China stand the possibility of running out of money on this Belt and Road Initiative?
Not yet. It could happen. But, you know, there's an enormous divergence between some of the grand statements China makes about Belt and Road and the actual investment activity that we see proceeding. So far, they are well within any kind of reasonable estimate of what kind of investment and debt they can afford. So they would have to expand current activity by, say, 4 or 5 times before we start to have a problem with it.
VOA Asia's Ira Melman speaking with Dr. Barry Naughton, professor of economics at the School of Global Policy Strategy at the University of California in San Diego, California. Happening now in Asia, India says there are 21 million unwanted girls across the country. The Indian government's annual economic survey blames illegal gender-based abortions for a sex ratio of 940 females for every 1,000 males, according to the latest census data. Preference for sons is rampant, especially in rural communities. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad to have you with us today on VOA Asia. The foreign ministers of longtime rivals China and Japan, Wang Yi and Taro Kono, met in Beijing Sunday for talks that could pave the way for an eventual trilateral free trade pact involving South Korea. The meeting took place on the 40th anniversary of the signing of the China-Japan Treaty of Peace and Friendship. Animosities stem from Japan's invasion and partial occupation of China before and during World War II, recent territorial tensions in the East China Sea, the North Korean nuclear menace, and proposed amendments to Japan's post-war pacifist constitution have not improved things. But President Xi Jinping and Prime Minister Shinzo Abe met on the sidelines of a regional summit in Vietnam in November. Both sides would appear to gain from improving ties. Yoichiro Sato is a security studies professor at Reitsmuken Asia Pacific University in Japan, and he tells VOA's Victor Beatty that the two countries appear to be on course to repair past damage to bilateral ties.
But as far as China is concerned, this is not for China's like really long-term strategy, but more like a tactical move in light of two ongoing events. One is that China's economy is slowing down, and China is definitely looking for a way to attract more Japanese investments, hopefully try to lure Japan into a trilateral free trade arrangement with South Korea. For Japan, this is not a bad opportunity because the U.S., you know, withdrew from TPP and Donald Trump's condition for returning into the TPP is still very much based on the U.S. interests, and Japan does not feel a strong desire to renegotiate the TPP on behalf of the United States. The second issue is the Korean Peninsula. China does feel slight but some significant possibility that the U.S. will actually resort to a military action against North Korea, and China wants to prevent that by any means. Rather, China wants to create a momentum for corporate restructuring of anti-North Korea coalition.
Of course, the two countries have a territorial dispute in the East China Sea. There's also a concern about the possibility of amending Japan's pacifist constitution. That has been a source of concern in Beijing.
Yes, but I think China has resigned to the fact that the constitutional amendment has a good chance of succeeding under Abe. I think China has done everything to prepare itself for that kind of occurrence. On the issue of territorial dispute, I don't think China has changed its policy at all, if not made it more aggressive. I think the ongoing plan for the foreign ministerial talk, as well as a possible summit talks between Abe and Xi Jinping, will do anything to ameliorate the dispute.
Chinese Premier Li Keqiang, who took part in Sunday's meeting, said while bilateral relations are still confronted with uncertainties, they are also of great significance to the region and the world. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news alert from VOA Asia, South Korea's unification ministry, says North Korea has canceled a joint cultural performance with the South planned ahead of the Winter Olympic Games. Pyongyang blamed South Korean media for encouraging, quote, insulting public sentiment regarding the North and canceled the February 4th event. Visit VOA Asia Facebook each day. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, the North Korean women's ice hockey team is in South Korea to prepare for the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics. The two governments reached an agreement to play together wearing the same jerseys and marching under a unified peninsula flag, Arash Arabasadi reports.
North Korea's women's ice hockey team arrived by bus Thursday at South Korea's National Training Center to prepare for the 2018 Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. The last time South Korea hosted an Olympics was the Summer Games of 1988, but North Korea boycotted the competition.
We are very happy to participate in the joint team for North and South Korea. I believe there will be a good result if we put our minds and strength together and prepare well for the matches.
South Korea's coach recently voiced concern the unified team would be ill-prepared without chemistry.
No team wants to lose at the games. Our goal is trying our best to show good performances by using our physical skills.
Earlier in the day, officials from North Korea's Ministry of Physical Culture and Sports arrived to inspect the venue. And despite early concerns about team unity among players who had never practiced together, it was all smiles between the coaches and team members of the Korean women's ice hockey team. Wearing the same jersey and marching under a united flag of the Korean Peninsula, the women's unified ice hockey team now has about 2 weeks to train before the start of the Winter Olympics. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
This news alert from VOA Asia, court testimony Monday in the murder case of the half-brother of North Korean leader Kim Jong-un revealed Kim Jong-nam met with an unidentified American in Malaysia 4 days before he was shockingly assassinated. Two women are on trial, and Malaysian investigators say four unidentified suspects are still at large. All the big stories come your way throughout the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, it's all fun and games until a family gets behind the wheel. Well, that's the whole idea behind Volvo's Drive Me project. Automotive vehicles are now being tested by families as part of a multi-stage experiment that's taking place in Norway. VOA's Steve Reddish takes us down this new road.
The Simonovsky family is taking part in a test to see how real people respond to automated vehicles.
It's exciting to be in the forefront of developing new technology and new functionality in new cars. So that was the thing that caught my attention and my interest.
The family is driving a semi-autonomous Volvo on the road as part of a five-stage plan to get automated vehicles out of the labs and onto the roads. Stage two means the car can operate in an autonomous mode, but the driver still has to do a lot of the heavy lifting, like changing lanes and making turns.
Now the car, because now we're on the highway going south towards Malmö, so now the car will propose to me to go into autonomous drive. This is an 80 kilometers an hour stretch.
With a simple flick of a switch, the car goes into autonomous mode.
When I get out on the highway, the car will ask me whether I would like to go into autopilot. And I will do that by pulling the paddles on the steering wheel. And then I will go into enjoying the opportunity of unsupervised AD.
The purpose of letting real people try out the technology is because how drivers react is nearly as important as how well the car works.
This car is a research car, and it's really important to understand that the car does not drive by itself due to technology. It has a backup driver. The reason that we use this car is to be able to test with real people on real roads what a fully self-driving car would be experienced like in 2021.
In stage three, the car will take control of more driving functions, and in stage four, the car will control everything and only ask for human help in an emergency. Volvo is hoping to begin field testing stage four cars by 2021. Steve Reddish, VOA News.
Rough estimates are that about 2 of every 100 people around the world have or need replacement joints. As VOA's Kevin Enix has discovered, some Polish doctors are using stem cell technology to rebuild worn-out cartilage instead of replacing it with metal.
Cartilage, the white stuff you see here, keeps bones from rubbing against each other. It's the body's shock absorber. But age or overuse can wear it away. That usually means surgery and a metal joint replacement. But a team of Polish doctors is using stem cells instead to grow new cartilage, and it's working.
The novelty of this method lies in the fact that we use umbilical cord stem cells that are capable of reproducing cartilage.
Not only is it a way to get the body to fix itself, it's much less invasive than joint replacement surgery.
We put these cells on a so-called scaffold, a bioimplant, and this interface together with the cells are put on the cartilage defect in the knee or ankle joint.
It's not a perfect fix, but people who have had the surgery say it works.
2 months have passed since then. At the moment, the leg is so effective that I can walk without crutches in the room. I still use crutches to go up the stairs.
The stem cell replacement therapy is in its early stages, and it could one day completely replace the need for metal joints.
Today, we are on the way to replacing a metal hip joint with a biological one. We are only at the beginning of this path, and we cannot say that we are completely replacing it yet. But if we can postpone the need for a metal prosthesis in some patients, that would be a great success for us.
Only 12 patients have received the stem cell replacement so far. Studies are being done on its effectiveness in the hopes of pushing the technology even further. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. And wherever you happen to be listening, we're glad you've been with us today. If you happen to be in Malaysia, catch us on the radio at HELPS Radio at HELP University in Kuala Lumpur. We thank everyone there who is listening today. As we always thank our director, Tracy Carter, engineer Jimmy Cook, managing editor Diane Gao, Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, and David Bird. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.